This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the Sandbox Party hopes to attract attention this year to issues affecting children as voters make decisions in the August primary and the November general election. But first, there is one proposal before voters in Michigan on the August ballot. It would repeal the personal property tax and direct state tax dollars to local units of government to make up for the revenue that they currently receive from that tax. That ballot proposal has no organized opposition. The Citizens Research Council of Michigan has prepared an analysis of Proposal 1. Eric Lufer is Research Director for the Citizens Research Council. Eric Lufer, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Explain the background of the personal property tax. How does this work?
The personal property tax is a tax on the things that aren't attached to the ground. We have two kinds of tax base for property taxes. The real property is the land and the buildings on it, and the personal property is everything that you put inside that building or things not attached. So in this case, we're mostly concentrated on industrial personal property. That would be the machinery that we put in to make the cars in Michigan, the machinery for making chairs and the things that go on the west side of the state. It's all industry is affected, and computers, desks, just about everything that a business would own for purposes of industrial production is considered industrial personal property.
So why is this tax unpopular with some members of the business community, and as well as many state lawmakers who have said that they support this proposal on the August ballot?
It's unpopular for a couple of reasons, and it's been unpopular for a long time. We have studies back in the 1960s that we were looking for ways to get rid of the personal property tax. The first reason is that it's the general principle, if you want something less of something, you should tax it. So if you want more of something, you should tax it less. It was seen as adverse to businesses if they were looking for a place to locate to engage in industry. This was a higher cost of operations, lower return on investment, and so for that reason it was unpopular. It was also seen as double taxation, so that when you purchased a computer, when you purchased a desk, when you purchased the machinery that was needed to engage in this activity, you would pay the sales tax on it. Then you put it in your factory, and you are taxed again as a personal property tax. So for those two reasons, it was not very popular.
So explain now what Proposal 1 on the August ballot will do about the personal property tax.
So the proposal that's been handed down by the legislature is to exempt industrial personal property from taxation. That doesn't affect the state government as much as it affects local governments, so they needed to find a way to reimburse local governments. In a convoluted system that was created because of the distrust between the state and local governments and a bad past history of fiscal relations between the two levels of government, they created a independent special unit of government that's ostensibly a local unit of government, but it shares its boundaries with the whole state. And that local unit of government would have taxing authority to come up with the money to reimburse local governments for their lost property taxes. It's not going to increase the amount of taxation that people pay for every amount of increase in the use tax that this local government would levy. The state use tax rate would go down by an equal amount. So that's really the question that's before the voters. Do you want to levy this tax to reimburse local governments for lost personal property tax revenues? But everything else is tied to this vote, so that if the people vote no on this, the whole thing falls apart and we're back to taxing personal property and looking for another solution.
And just to explain the legalities here, why is a statewide vote required on this proposal?
So they called it, even though it's a shares its boundaries with the state, they created it under the authority in the local government section of the Michigan Constitution. And very clearly in the statute said this is not part of state government. In a different part of our state constitution, what we call the Headley Amendment, it says that any time a local unit of government is going to levy a tax, the people have to approve that. There must be a vote on it. So even though we've been paying the use tax all along, it's a state tax, they're calling it, part of it now, a local tax, and the Headley Amendment says the people have to vote before a local tax can be levied.
Your report includes a list of the local units of government that rely most heavily on the personal property tax, and that includes a couple of communities in southwest Michigan, Covert Township and Three Rivers. Is it fair to say that these communities have a larger stake in the August ballot question?
Well, again, they're going to be held harmless by this, whether they continue to levy the personal property tax on industry in their jurisdictions or that property becomes exempt and they're reimbursed by the state. Their revenue should be about revenue neutral. They shouldn't really suffer a loss from this. We put this table in to try to get people to understand really where the industrial property is located. And if the state should not live up to it, the bargain, these would be then the communities that would stand to be hurt by it. But the state's tried to put in some assurances that these communities, that the revenue will be there and these communities should not be hurt.
So where does the money come from in order to hold these local units of government harmless?
So as I said, we currently have a state use tax, and the idea is to divert part of that use tax to reimbursing local units of government. The state's counting on some more money coming in with tax credits that will expire and with a new tax. It's called a state essential services tax. So there will be some new money coming in, but it's taking money out of the state general fund, basically, money that would otherwise go into the state general fund, and using it for reimbursement. So that's really the thing that people have to think about as they weigh whether to vote yes or no on this tax. Local governments should be held harmless. Things should keep on going at the local level as they have been. But at some point, there will be less money at the state. We think about $300 to $500 million that isn't paying for schools, for roads, for corrections, for all the things that the state government pays for.
So if that holds true, then does it mean that this ballot proposal is going to mean either cutting some state spending or raising revenue some other way to make up the difference?
Well, that's a bit of crystal ball gazing. The general purpose of cutting property taxes, personal property taxes, is to spur economic growth. If, in fact, that occurs, then this may pay for itself. But if it doesn't occur, then there will be those sort of hard questions for future legislative sessions. If the state does not have sufficient revenues to pay for the things it pays, currently pays for, that will either mean finding more money or cutting back on certain things.
Reading from the summary of the Citizens Research Council report, it says valid arguments have been advanced by supporters of the PPT repeal that the reforms will enhance business competitiveness and encourage additional private sector investment. Is the tough part when you're doing an analysis such as this one by the Citizens Research Council in determining how much new revenue will come in to see if it, in fact, will pay for itself? In other words, does that require crystal ball gazing, which is perhaps beyond the scope of what you or anybody else is capable of doing at this point?
Right. It's beyond the scope of us or anyone else, as you suggest. But it also, there are so many other wild cards. We know for the last decade that Michigan went into recession in 2001, along with the rest of the nation. The rest of the nation came out shortly after that, but Michigan continued in recession until the Great Recession of a few years ago. So while we think this will make Michigan a more business-friendly place, what happens to the rest of the economy? What happens to automotive purchases or business furniture purchases or anything else that is so important to Michigan? Those will play probably a bigger role than what's the amount of taxation on industrial personal property.
Earlier, we talked about some of the communities which rely most heavily on revenue from the personal property tax. If we broaden that out, though, and we look across the state, are there many communities where it's not a big factor one way or another?
Yes, there are far more communities that have no industrial personal property in their jurisdiction, and they get nothing from the personal property part of their tax base. They're simply receiving receiving real taxation on real property. So you can imagine the communities around Kalamazoo in that southwest part of the state that are just so heavily residential. And you would say those are communities, there is no industry really, and they're just going to go on as they have been going on. This won't affect them at all.
The report makes a couple of references, and I believe you've also stated this as well during this interview, about the strained fiscal relationship between the state and local units of government. Can you talk a little bit about what precisely that means and how that may have come into play when this proposal was being crafted?
So if you can go back to the 1930s when the state was taking action to exempt part of the property tax base from taxation and told local governments, if you go along with this, the state will send out money and you should be held harmless from it. That happened in the 30s. It happened years after that. It happened again in the 70s. And then we got to this last decade when, again, the state was dealing with this recession that just went on and on and on. And the state made a pattern of pulling back on the amount of money available for state revenue sharing at the expense of local governments. And so it really has created a strained relationship that the local governments just don't trust the promises made by the state administration or the state legislature will be kept in future years. When push comes to shove and the state needs money to fund things, will they say those needs are greater than the local government needs, and therefore we need to cut back on how much money is going to local governments? So you can imagine how this might have played out without such a strained relationship. The state might have told local governments, we understand you depend on this part of your property tax base. Let us exempt it. That'll be good for your tax base. More businesses will want to locate there. And in exchange, we'll send you the money through an appropriations process that'll get you what you need. But the local governments said, local government associations told the state, either you need to put this in the Constitution or you need to create a system where we have some certainty that that's money going to come. And so we're putting it to a vote of the people because of this complicated system they've created.
Eric Luford, thank you for your time.
All right. Glad to help.
Eric Luford is Research Director for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Citizens Research Council of Michigan's full report on Proposal 1 on the August ballot can be found at crcmich.org. A link is also available at our website, wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In the run-up to the August primary and then to the general election in November, voters will hear from candidates for state and federal office. They'll also hear from various interest groups hoping to influence those elections. But Michigan voters are also being asked to consider a group that doesn't have a lobbyist or a political action committee. The Michigan Sandbox Party hopes to draw attention to the issues affecting children in the state. The Sandbox Party, a project of the advocacy organization Michigan's Children, plans to highlight issues of importance to young people this election season. Matt Gillard is the CEO of Michigan's Children. Matt Gillard, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
Tell us a little bit more about the Sandbox Party, maybe its history and its organization, what it's made up of.
Well, the Sandbox Party started as a grassroots network of early childhood advocates and supporters around 4 years ago, and we really have mobilized a large number of people throughout Michigan that cared about early childhood and investment in quality early childhood programs and opportunities. We've kind of expanded the focus beyond just early childhood and really are focusing on children's issues from cradle to career. And at this point are really focused on this election, this upcoming election we have here in Michigan. This is a very important election. We have our entire state legislature up this August and November, as well as the governor, the attorney general, and secretary of state's offices. We also have our entire congressional delegation up in an open U.S. Senate seat. A number of very interesting congressional primaries as well, with some retirements and other things that you don't see often happen. So in all, this is going to be a very exciting but also very important time for the future of Michigan with this election season.
So going forward, do you plan to endorse candidates for office in this election season?
No, that's not the way our organization has been founded or set up. Really, what we're trying to do at this point, even before the primary, is just highlight the importance of voting in the primary. And then really just providing a resource for people to easily learn about the candidates that are running for office in their area. We will not be endorsing candidates, but we really want to give people an opportunity to get engaged in this election process, to learn about the people that are running to represent them in our democracy, and to make informed decisions as they head to the polls, hopefully in August and then in November.
Are there certain issues that you will be providing information about or perhaps even advocating one way or another on?
Well, not through the election process. Now, Michigan's Children is an advocacy organization that advocates for children and families issues in our legislature and through Washington as well. But really, our election opportunities are really just about giving people the resource to learn more about the candidates and to make the decisions themselves. I think it's pretty easy to get engaged in the process if people have the opportunity to learn about the candidates. And that's really what we're trying to do through the Michigan Sandbox Party right now, is to provide an easy resource for people to go online, to quickly log in to MichiganSandboxParty.org, and to find out who's running for office in their area and what these candidates are saying about issues around children and families.
Your website has highlighted a handful of races for Congress, including the 3rd District, which includes Battle Creek and Grand Rapids, and also the state legislature. And among the districts you're looking at there are the 60th, which includes the city of Kalamazoo, and the 80th, which includes most of Allegan County. And these are really looking at the primaries right now. Why did you pick these races in particular?
Well, we highlighted a few congressional races, a few state Senate races, and a few state House races that I think are good examples of the importance of voting in the August primary. All of these races that we highlighted are likely to be determined in the August 5th primary, either by the Democratic side or the Republican side, depending upon how they were drawn. So, for example, the 3rd Congressional District is, fairly, from a baseline standpoint, is a fairly Republican district. So it's very likely that whoever wins that Republican primary August 5th is going to be the representative in Washington for that area for the next 2 years. Similarly, the 60th House seat on the other side is a fairly Democratic-based district. And so whoever wins that Democratic primary is very likely to win the general election in November. And what we want people to understand is because of the way these districts are drawn, it is very important to vote in these August 5th primaries. We see historically, we've seen very low turnout in August primary elections here in Michigan. And really, that's not unique to Michigan. Around the country, you see very low turnout in these primary elections. But increasingly, the way these districts are drawn in such a partisan manner, it's those elections that determine who are going to be our representatives in Lansing and in Washington in the coming years. And so really, our primary goal is to get more people who care about children and care about children's issues to participate in these August primaries. We firmly believe that if more people who care about kids vote in August, we'll be better off as far as having our issues considered in the years to come.
If we were only thinking about children and children's issues when we decided to vote, what would be the issues that we would focus on? What are the things that stand out which really affect children and families from the whole range of issues that people may decide which candidate to support?
Well, I think that's up for people themselves to decide individually. But I think, in general, obviously education and issues around our education system get a lot of attention. But I don't know that there's a lot of concrete ideas or opinions shared by candidates all the time. Some do, some don't. Some have backgrounds in education issues that provide them maybe more perspective. But certainly education funding, but education policy issues as well. I mean, we're seeing a kind of emerging debate here around charter schools and the accountability of charter schools here in Michigan based on some of the media reports that came out of the Free Press. That's one example. Early childhood is something I mentioned earlier that the Sandbox Party was kind of founded on. You know, we've seen some real, I think, success from the early childhood perspective here in Michigan recently with some large increase in state funding for our quality preschool program to provide preschool opportunities to at-risk four-year-olds. But there's still a lot of work to be done. We know from the brain science and other research that, you know, strong birth to age three programs are needed for a lot of children, especially those that are maybe at most at risk of not being successful in school later in life. So we need to do more around those issues. And I think there's a number of children's health issues that often get overlooked. You know, we kind of have a national debate going on right now or continuing to some extent over the Affordable Care Act and that's implementation. But lost in that debate a lot of times is how those policy decisions are impacting children's health issues, both here in Michigan and across the country. Then there are a number of other issues. We have, you know, juvenile justice and the foster care system. Receives some attention at times from different candidates or different entities around the state, but I don't think nearly enough. And I think these are issues that people need. That the unique thing about a children's advocacy organization is you have a lot of people get engaged or get involved that have a particular focus area that may draw them into the process or into the system, and that's great. So we really just want to provide resources so that folks, no matter what issues around kids they care about, they can learn easily about the issue and then learn about what the candidates are saying about the issue and give them an opportunity to talk directly to the candidate. So one of the things you'll see on the website as well is a calendar function where you'll be able to put in the area where you live, either by zip code or by county, and find out what events are happening in your area that'll give you an opportunity to hear from the candidates themselves or even question the candidates themselves, whether it be candidate forums or other public appearances by either local candidates or statewide candidates.
You mentioned that some of these issues tend to get overlooked. Is that because there is not a natural sort of a big money push behind them? There's no great lobbying effort that comes that's going to lead to greater profits or those sort of things down the line for someone.
I think to some extent, yes, that's true. And I think particularly that's true in the election process. I think because we have seen such low turnout. So, for example, and you mentioned the 80th House District race. In that race, those candidates are vying for the Republican nomination, so to win this Republican primary on August 5th. What they're gearing towards, they're really focusing their message and their efforts to those folks that they know are going to vote in that August 5th Republican primary. And that's maybe 12 to 14%, maybe six at the high end, 16% of all registered voters in that district. And so they're gearing their message towards those that are on the further, you know, further to the right of the political spectrum that are most likely to vote in that August primary. And so the issues that those people care about is what they're talking about. And so we really believe that if we want to change this dynamic and get candidates elected and get candidates to care about or to focus on issues related to kids and families, we've got to get people who care about kids and families issues to participate in those August primaries.
So I noted you're highlighting some state legislative races, but also some races for Congress. I'm wondering if you find that there's some separation of issues between federal and state, that some things are more important at the federal level and other things at the state level are perhaps a little more in focus.
Oh, certainly. You know, I think this immigration debate is an obvious example of that. You know, that's clearly a federal issue. Now, I'm certain that you'll see state legislative candidates talking about immigration either on either side of the issue in some of their political dialogue leading up to the election. But the reality is that's a federal issue that, Congress is going to have to deal with one way or the other here in the coming years. Even within children's issues specifically, like education, I mean, I think there's a role clearly that the federal government plays in education. But then obviously there's a greater role, I think, from a state level standpoint. As far as prioritizing education and educational opportunities for children in different areas. the healthcare side of things as well, I think, is similar to education, where you have a federal role now, especially maybe an increased federal role with the Affordable Care Act, but also state policies and priorities as well that can impact education or health issues for children and for families.
So we've been talking a lot about the primaries. Do you then broaden these efforts out when you get to the general election, perhaps focus on more races, or do you perhaps find some races where you believe they'll be more competitive and perhaps people will have a better chance to influence that election and perhaps do it by raising these particular issues?
Yes, absolutely. No, that's the idea, is that after the primary, we will shift focus to some other races that we think are more competitive in the general election, and also maybe more focus on some of the statewide races where we don't see the primaries right now, such as the governor's race and the United States Senate race, and others where, you know, we have statewide candidates. And so we'll really be giving people opportunities to learn more about candidates either at the statewide level or in local races that are going to be competitive in the general election.
Matt, have you gotten some feedback on this? Do people appreciate that you're making this effort, and do they think that it's something that is going to enable them to cast a more informed vote?
Absolutely, yes. The feedback has been extremely positive. People find the website useful. I think are learning to use it as a resource. And really, we've even had candidates reach out after hearing me on radio stations or seeing some of our materials through the media. Candidates reach out wanting to make sure that any events that they're having or that they're attending are included on the website, and wanting to be helpful as much as possible to get their information out to voters as well. So, no, I think the reaction has been positive. I think it remains to be seen how effective we are, but I'm committed, and we're all committed to the idea that if we can get more people who care about children and family issues to participate here in the August primary, we'll be better off. And similarly in November, I mean, I shouldn't, you know, just relegate this to August right now. That's our focus now until August 5th. But even in our November elections, in these off presidential years, we don't see as high a turnout as I think we would like, or as I think our democracy deserves. I mean, the opportunity for people to participate is at the ballot box. And we often say kids can't vote, so people who care about them need to.
Are you sending questionnaires to candidates, getting their views on a range of issues?
We have not done that. We may do that. It's something we're considering doing between the August and November elections to those who are successful through the primaries. I'll be honest, I've been involved with that through different endeavors in previous elections with maybe some mixed results. I think it's more important than a standard questionnaire that candidates may or may not fill out, or may have somebody else fill out for them. I think it's more important, or a better opportunity for us to get people access, easy access to the candidates themselves and to the candidates' materials that they have already put together. You know, all of these candidates have websites, have materials that they've produced themselves, and I think that's leads to a better informed electorate or opportunity for people, voters, to learn more about the candidates.
Matt Gilbert, thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Matt Gilbert is the CEO of Michigan's Children. Links with more information about the Sandbox Party and Michigan's Children can be found at WMUK.org. West Southwest can be heard Monday and Thursday mornings at 9:20 on WMUK. You can always find current and past programs, including longer versions of interviews, at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.